Good morning. Today I'm going to share a children's book called What is God by E. Boritzer, and it's adapted. What is God? You are asking a very, very big question. Boys and girls, grown-ups, young and old people, everyone wants to know, what is God? People who live in forests and mountains, people who live in deserts, in cities, on farms, everyone wants to know, what is God? Maybe we can't really talk about God because maybe we can't see God, or maybe we can't hear God, or even taste or smell or touch God. Maybe we can only feel God, like we can feel love, or like we can feel happy or sad. Maybe God is what you feel when you stand on a very high mountain and see a big, beautiful view all around you. Or maybe God is what you feel when you hear beautiful music, sometimes soft, sometimes loud. Or maybe God is what you feel when you see a million stars at night and you feel very small looking up at them. Maybe we can feel God when there's a loud thunder or bright lightning outside our windows. Long ago, people thought that the sun was God, like a very strong and great light that shines through and around everything. But now we know the sun is just one star, and really just one small star, in a big universe filled with millions of stars. Some people think that God is an old man with a long white beard. They think that this God knows everything, everything we do or say or even think. Sometimes they think this God is a nice old man, but sometimes they think this God is an angry old man. And some people think that if we're not good, this God will be angry with us. Some people think that God is a woman or the energy from nature, or spirits that have gone before us. Maybe God is just an eternal mystery. Is there anyone here who can really tell us how all the many pieces of this big and forever puzzle called God fit together? Some people think that there are teachers who have been able to solve the puzzle, what is God? These teachers, men, women, and even children, have come from many places throughout the world and have talked in many different languages about the question, what is God? Some of these teachers are still alive today, but most of the great teachers lived a long time ago, and people passed their teachings along to their children, who passed it on to their children, and so on. The passing on of these teachings went on for many, many years, and that's how many religions got started. A religion is a belief held by a group of people who all understand God in the same way, usually as one teacher taught them about God. There are many, many teachers who have taught many, many different people, many, many different things about God. But if there are so many different ways to learn about the forever puzzle of God, how can we even begin to understand God? You see, every religion is different, and people of every religion understand God in their own way. Most religions, however, teach you that you should be good to other people, just like you would want other people to be good to you. Most religions say that you should not lie or steal. They say that you should not hurt people. There are many ways that all religions are the same. If everyone thought about all the ways in which all the different religions are the same, maybe people wouldn't have so many fights about all the different answers to the question, what is God? But wait, there are many more people who believe that there are many gods, not just one God. And there are some places in the world where you're not allowed to talk about God, and where there are no places allowed to even pray together about God. But our country, we believe that everyone can pray according to his or her own religion, and everybody is allowed to ask, what is God? So if you really want to feel God as you understand God to be, you can close your eyes now and listen to your breath go slowly in and out. And think how you are connected to everything, even if you are not touching everything. Try to feel how you are connected to your parents. Try to feel how you are part of your whole family, your brothers and sisters, your grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, even your friends. And try to feel how all of those people are part of a whole bigger family, and how all the families of the world, even those we can't see or touch, are really a part of you and your family. And if you can start to feel God like that, then maybe you will soon feel the whole answer to that very, very big question that everyone asks, what is God? Thank you.
As you know, sometimes I like to tell a little story at this part of the service, and this one seemed to fit with our theme for the day. There was a couple that had two boys, ages about 8 and 10, and these boys were excessively mischievous. They were always getting into trouble, and their parents knew that if any misconduct occurred in their town, their sons were probably involved. The boy's mother heard that a clergyman in town had been successful in theologically disciplining children. So she asked if he would speak with her boys, and the clergyman agreed, but asked to see them individually. So the mother sent her 8-year-old in first that morning with the other boy to see the clergyman in the afternoon. The clergyman was a huge man with a booming voice, and he sat the young boy down and started into his theological diatribe by demanding of the boy, "Where is God?" The boy's mouth dropped open, but he made no response, sitting there with his mouth hanging open wide. So the clergyman repeated the question in an even stronger tone, "Where is God?" And again the boy made no attempt to answer. So the clergyman raised his voice even more and shook his finger in the boy's face and bellowed, "Where is God?" The boy screamed and bolted, ran from the room, ran directly home, and dove into his closet, slamming the door behind him. And when his older brother found him in the closet and asked him what had happened, the younger brother, gasping for breath, replied, "We are in big trouble this time, dude. God is missing, and they think we did it." Well, in this church, we are not here to scare children away with blame and theological strong-arm tactics. In fact, even if you are a bit mischievous in this church, we still recognize your inherent goodness and encourage you along your path. And that's true if you're 8 or 80. That's how liberal religion works. And surely, that's worthy of your generous support. Our second reading is from the Hebrew Bible, First Book of Kings, chapter 19. This reading is about the prophet Elijah, a prophet who, at this Passover time of the year, is particularly remembered. For as those of you who have participated in a Seder know, we pour a glass of wine for Elijah and we open the door for him to enter the room, reminding us that he was a great crusader for justice and righteousness. And this ritual symbolizes the idea that he'll return to usher in that time when real peace and justice come. In this reading, we meet Elijah in a very different place, hiding in a cave. He's been through the high times. His prayers for the end of the drought were answered with rains. He has slain his enemies, the prophets of the false gods, and he's been proud and boastful and taken the lead in great celebrations. But now things have changed. He's withdrawn, depressed, fearful, and his spirits are low. He's waiting for something, some experience. And here's the account in the book of Kings of what he experiences. "A great and powerful wind tore the mountain apart and shattered the rocks into pieces, but God was not in the wind. And after the wind there was an earthquake, but God was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake a fire, but God was not in the fire. And after the fire came a still small voice." Some would translate it as a gentle whisper inside. "When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. And behold, there came that voice in him, and it said, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?'" I invite you now to rise as you're able and join in song, hymn number 2, "Down the Ages We've Trod."
Down
the ages we have trod, many pass in search of God, seeking ever to define the eternal and divine. Some have turned eternal God, pictured best in parenthood, and a being throned above, ruling over us in love. There are others who proclaim God in nature are the same, and the present Godhead of, where creation's laws are known. There are eyes which best can see God within humanity, and God's countenance their trace written in a human face. Where compassion moves around is for some the hallowed ground, and these paths they are put on, teaching us that love is God. Truth we can't perceive, this at least we must believe. What we take most earnest in is our living deity. How to God they ne'er shall find, in what claims our heart and mind, and our hidden thoughts enshrine that which for us is. Please be seated. As most of you know, I practiced law for many years prior to going into ministry. And when it first became known that I was leaving my legal practice to enter Harvard Divinity School and become a minister, I received a variety of strange reactions. On several occasions, when someone learned I was going to school to become a minister, he or she would sort of quickly put up a wall and say something like, "Oh, I don't believe in God." Now, I'm sure they thought this would quickly end the conversation, but it often did not, and they frequently became rather confused. First, if they found out I was going to be a Unitarian Universalist minister, and if they knew anything about our wide range of beliefs from theistic to non-theistic, they quickly became concerned that instead of slamming the door on a religious conversation, their statement might have accidentally thrown it open. Over time, I actually became so used to this proclamation that I formulated a pat response to it. I would reply, "I probably don't believe in the God you don't believe in either." Now, despite the warning against double negatives from my English teachers, I rather like this reply. For most who were familiar with both our tradition and with contemporary theology's numerous ways at looking at the idea of God, my answer was okay, but to others it was perplexing, if not outright shocking. As Unitarian Universalist, it's okay to say that you don't believe in God. We welcome and embrace folks with a wide variety of theological views here, from the most traditional Orthodox theists to atheists. To be a member of this church, you are not required to profess a creed in a particular God, or any God, for that matter. For us, what we believe is a matter of individual choice, not a membership requirement. And many of us are not exactly sure what we do believe. Perhaps You initially came to this church because of what you no longer believed in some other religion. I think it's quite easy to articulate the things that we don't believe. But it's quite another matter to articulate the really fundamental things that we do believe. In life, we learn that there is much mystery, much we cannot understand, and yet I think we all still have a desire to understand it. The artist Paul Klee tells a little story in his journal that I want to share with you. He writes, "There are two mountains on which all is bright and clear, the mountain of the animals and the mountain of the gods. But between them lies the shadowy valley of humankind. When we gaze upward, we know that we do not know. We are seized as in a premonition with a restless longing towards those who do not know that they do not know and those who know they know." As human beings, we don't have that bliss, if you will, of the animal kingdom, nor do most of us have that certainty that we might ascribe to the gods. We live in the questions of life. We constantly try to transcend the limits of the valley to the clear spot on the mountaintop where we may see at least a glimpse of what is true and ultimate and what gives life meaning for us. To put it another way, theological engagement is part of the human condition. It is the product of living in the valley. Unitarian minister George Kimmich Beach expressed it this way: "Everyone reflects at one time or another on that which gives life meaning and value. In this sense, with or without God language, everyone is a theologian." Many people here struggle with both what is ultimately true for them and then what to call it. I have had profound and rich conversations with some of you about your concept of God, and other members have expressed a dislike for the very term God. Some colleagues of mine say jokingly that you can preach on anything you want in a Unitarian Universalist church except God. But I hope that in the variety of 10 years of sermons now, that we can also focus on this issue too. No matter how or if we articulate it, we all claim some ultimate truth. In the words we sang just a few minutes ago, what we claim most earnestly is our living deity. And like everyone else, at times we too struggle with the big questions. We are searchers for meaning and we struggle to define our truth. It is this struggle, this engagement with ultimate questions, that makes us more than a social club or a group of do-gooders. It is what makes us a religious people. Neither the animals in that story nor the gods in that story on their mountains are religious. We, like those before us, are religious, if you will, because we, with both our faith and our serious doubts, explore the big questions. Just like those who lived in biblical times did, we're making meaning of our world experience with the tools and the learning of our age. And we don't all come out in the same place. And that's fine. For some, the traditional loving parent God remains a very viable belief. I've seen the comfort that that can provide and honor and respect that belief. But for many others, however, the traditional idea of God as an all-powerful creator, controller, patriarchal being existing in human likeness in some different perfect world of another dimension is not believable or meaningful. For some Unitarian Universalists, as well as those from other religions, this God is more than just not believable. It is damaging. The patriarchy of this male deity, the lowly position of women in relation to him, still demean women and prevent them from enjoying their equal rights. In many churches, the teachings ascribed to this God prevent women from contributing to society in roles beyond that of mother or homemaker, and it certainly is a bar from them being ministers in their churches. Many of us, often after painful periods in our lives, have rejected the idea of a vengeful, judgmental God, ready to punish us in this life or in the next, often for things over which we had no control. We have finally freed ourselves from that pain, and we're not sure we want to get too close to any God concept again. And still others, whose learned minds are guided by rational and scientific methods, find this ancient God inconsistent with evolution, causation, and other well-accepted scientific theories, and thus have rejected him. Finally, others have lost faith in this God when they felt that he was not there, particularly in extreme times such as genocides we experienced in the last century. They questioned why, if God is all-powerful, did he not intervene? If God is all-loving, how could he let this happen? The conclusion for some is that in a world where this can happen, there must be no God. These questions have not only been asked on the grand scale of world events. Most of us who grew up with this view of God and perhaps encountered a tragic or event or injustice have probably asked the same question. When this particular God was not there for us, we, along with many philosophers and theologians, declared indeed that this God was dead. Yet, 92% of the American people, in a Gallup poll done this year, say they believe in God. Many rabbis and ministers and priests and imams still preach some flavor of the traditional God. But many others, not just among Unitarian Universalists, but also in liberal temples and churches and places of worship and other denominations, now mean something very different by the term God. While some have rejected the notion of God and find it unnecessary for their spiritual life, many others have instead looked to redefine God. Now, this practice should not be surprising to us. Redefining God in terms of our own times and understanding of the world is what people have done for centuries. In our tradition, on our Unitarian side, we reshape the idea of God with the application of rational Enlightenment thought to biblical teachings. And on our Universalist side, we rejected the notion of a vengeful God hundreds of years ago and replaced it with the idea of a only loving God. Our transcendentalist forebears found God in nature and believed in the direct and unmediated first-hand experience of the sacred, saying we didn't need second-hand religion to know this God. We have rejected this term God, and we have redefined it in many ways throughout the ages. You know, my former colleagues in the legal profession, who quickly proclaimed to me their disbelief in God, operated from the premise that the term God means just one thing. And therefore, they thought that all ministers must be operating to advance that view. Surely, when you've spoken with folks from other religions, they may have said something to the effect, "Oh, well, we have different religious ideas, but we all believe in the same God." And although, out of politeness, I sometimes say nothing, in my heart, I'm saying, not so. I'm saying I need to know a lot more about how you experience God before I could agree with that statement. The idea that there might be other concepts of God than the orthodox, all-powerful, patriarchal, controlling old man with a beard who existed apart from the world has just never been considered by many people. Now today, we're barely scratching the surface in this exploration of other ways we might view God. And as we do, I pose two broad questions. Is there a way of understanding God that might fit within our post-Enlightenment scientific minds and is comfortable within a naturalistic view of the world? And is there reason to continue to use the term at all? On both of these questions, I know some will disagree with my conclusions. My reason for preaching this theological sermon is not an effort to convert those of you who are comfortable in your beliefs, either with a traditional God or with no God. If your theology is working for you, my job is to support you on that journey, and I hope you know that I will. But there are many sources for others' ideas of God, both ancient and modern. 20th century theologians from our denominations and many others have described the God belief in a way that is consistent with our present worldview. Feminist theologians, process theologians, and others have explained God in a way that has new meaning for many. Some start with a totally fresh idea, while others return to ancient traditions and ancient scriptures and examine those same texts that gave us the troubling God to see if there are other ideas present. In other words, is there a minority view, if you will? And perhaps surprisingly, the idea of a different kind of God, not a superhuman being residing in some far world, but a force of connection, of conscience, and love, come to us, or can come to us, from the same ancient scriptures that brought us that other God. There indeed is a minority view of God to be found in Hebrew and Christian scripture. This morning I read to you one of the passages from the scriptures that I believe present an idea of God very different from the prevailing notion of the Hebrew God. God is not in all the showy, powerful forces of the world. Rather, God is the still, small voice speaking within Elijah. God is not known to Elijah in spectacular ways, but is manifested as a voice of conscience. His experience of God, a God who's about to give him moral instruction as a guiding voice within him, is his experience. This idea of God is not unique to Christianity or Judaism or Islam. I was struck with its similarity to the Native American theology that was expressed in that responsive reading we shared. Many theologians and religious leaders of our time have left the old God behind, and at the same time have affirmed the God experience in their lives. One such person is John Shelby Spong. He's a retired Episcopal bishop. I've mentioned him before. He's the author of several books on liberal religion. He was a teacher of mine, and I'm still proud to count him as a friend. And in his book, A New Christianity for a New World, you might be rather surprised to hear what this Episcopalian has to say. He writes, "Theism is a human description of God that has died. I seek to walk beyond the carnage of that description into a new sense of God. A God not met outside of life, but at the very heart of life. My mind, my integrity, my intellectual questioning, and my God experience all come together in this new image. My religious schizophrenia is at an end. Theism is dead, I joyfully proclaim, but God is real." And for what this new God might be like, Spong returns to traditional scriptures and mines them for the minority view. And I'd like to share with you three characteristics that he derives from those scriptures, which provide a very different concept of a God. From Torah, he extracts an understanding that God and life are not separate, and those personal qualities ascribed to God as a creator, as a source of life, are really qualities within each of us. In unity with others, we can exercise a life-giving power. We can find the divine source of life within us when we expand the possibilities of life for ourselves and for others. So he would say to worship this God who is the source of life is to live your life fully and to share deeply. And next he turns to the Exodus story when Moses asks God his name and the reply is, "I am who I am," is my name. If we examine that phrase, Spong says, non-theistically, it suggests that the message is that God is the ground of your being, that to worship God is to show who you are to the world. To believe in that God is the ground of your being is to be your deepest and fullest self, to be all that you can be and not to be who you are not. And finally, he turns to the Christian Gospels that say that God is love. And with that old idea of God set aside, that God is not some in some distant place, but in us, the still small voice, tells us that if we believe in this God, we are to love wastefully in the world without regard to cost or benefit. So he'd say we worship this God in the times we express unconditional love. Now for me, the presence of that still small voice is the eternal flame of light that guides and the hope that doesn't fail. Holding this as a God experience reinforces the profound sense of mystery in which we lead our lives. You know, there are many ways to describe that of which I'm speaking without the term God. And if you've been coming here for a while, you know that I often do that. We all translate here in this church either up or down on the theological scale so that the message fits within our theological framework. And that is, in this kind of community, as it should be. But I also do use the word God. One of my colleagues described my God as having a small lowercase g. And in a way, that's true. Yet I believe there is value in using the word still, as well as using humanist language in our services. We need not give up on the term God or give it up to those who refuse to continue on the journey, to those for whom revelation is closed, those whose ideas of God has stagnated. If we relinquish the term, I think we run the risk of removing ourselves from meaningful participation in the moral debate of our time. It's important, I think, that we contribute our liberal views to the idea of what God is. The symbol has throughout history, the symbol God has throughout history been wide enough to hold inconsistent ideas, and I believe it still is. Using the term God can enrich our present ideas, and allow us to connect contemporary ideas with ancient wisdom as well. Now, of course, this is just my view. You must also know that I respect the diversity of views in this room. Some of you have very similar views to mine, and others have very different views. But surely your view for you is as true as mine is for me. We are all on a journey to both discover what rings true to us as the source of meaning, and then, to the best of our human ability, make that real in the world. On the journey, we may see things differently, but we are on the journey together. We live the questions together, and we support each other on that inner journey of finding personal truth.